And I just want to welcome everybody who's here tonight. I'm sure people will still be arriving, but I particularly want to welcome anyone who's here from, I know we had people register from other centers and from other countries. And if you're here already, I welcome you. I'm Donna Cease. I'm the Spiritual Program Coordinator for Kadapa Center. And just to tell you a little bit about Kadapa Center, we are an FPMT city center located in Raleigh, North Carolina. And we're about 25 years old, and we've had Venerable Rovina visit many times over the years, and we're very happy to have her here this evening and all this week. I don't know that there's much else to say about, well, there's a lot more to say about us, but you're here for Venerable Rovina, so. So I'll just go ahead and talk a little bit about Venerable Rovina's schedule this week. She is teaching from 7 to 9 p.m. Every evening this week except Thursday. Tomorrow night she'll be teaching on making friends with your inner roommate, how to use thought transformation. Wednesday night she'll be teaching about emptiness. Friday night she'll talk about renunciation and how that helps us. If we can master a little bit of renunciation, that gives us more happiness. And then on the weekend, she'll be teaching from 1 to 4 p.m. Both on Saturday and on Sunday. And she'll be teaching Saturday. I can't remember which day is which. I think Saturday is about how to keep calm in a hot political time. And Sunday is how to kind of keep our cool in the midst of all the difficult things that are happening in the world right now. So those are both topical topics. And we hope you'll join us for that. And Thursday night, if you are looking for more of Venerable Rovina, she will be completing a series of three teachings on death and rebirth that she's doing, hosted by Maitripa College. So I don't recall what time that is. And but you can find that if you look for Maitripa College. So Venerable Robina has been teaching in Mexico, and when she arrives, we're going to do a couple of things. One thing is we will be offering her a mandala like we would do if she were here physically. And it's also good. We're used to standing when the teacher arrives. And even though she's not physically here, that is a sign of respect, so we can stand when she arrives. I'll also mention that once the teachings begin, we will have everyone muted to avoid distractions and make it a little less cacophonous. But Venerable Robina, as you know, will always stop and provide an opportunity for questions, and we can use chat for that. And you know, you don't have to wait until she asks. You can enter a question in chat if you need to. Venerable Robina is here. Let's stand.
Hello.
Hello, Venerable.
Hello, darling. Hello, Donna. Hello, everybody. Hello, people. Can you see me?
Yes, we can.
I'm trying to get the lighting right, but I don't know if the light is shining in my face too much. What do you think?
No, you look lovely.
Is that okay? Oh, I'll turn the light off. Tell me if it's what's better. Hang on. I'm on the movie set. Is that better or worse?
Better. Equally good, I think. It's a more golden tone with a light on.
So we'll leave the light on. Can you see me? So I want to see all you guys, though. Who's up there? Miranda, Jill, Margaret. Who else is there? Let me have a look. Susie, Michael, Kelly, Kim, Mary, all of you. Look at you. Andre. Hello, Andre, darling. Andrew Hughes, wonderful. Susan, I can't say all your names. Don is there. Alan. Okay, how wonderful. So imagine we're all in the Gomba together. So I've done my three prostrations. So now if you're not good little Buddhists, you can pretend we're all together. So now I've sat down. Now you can do your prostrations. Imagine we're all in the presence of the Buddha himself, about to receive the teachings. So you decide to do that as you'd like. All right.
So,
what are we doing next, Donna? You're the boss.
Yes, sir. That'll be the day.
How you are. You're doing a pretty good job.
Okay. We would like to start, Venerable, with a offering of a mandala.
Wonderful. So Good. So what we're going to sing today, let's think of the meaning of it. Don't just think it's a nice piece of religion and we're going to do a funny prayer. So what, the meaning is very marvelous, actually. You know yourselves, if we went visiting somewhere place, we'd never go empty-handed. We'd come with a gift, wouldn't we? Well, we're thinking like that. We're going to, in the presence of the Buddha, we're going to make an offering requesting the Buddha for teaching. So we imagine the Buddha's there, we're going to request. This is so auspicious. So we imagine, and if we don't know Buddha's cosmological view of the universe, never mind about that, we just visualize our view of the universe, and we think of all the marvelous things on the planet that, make people happy. The beautiful objects of all the senses, we're going to offer all of those, pile them all up, and offer to the Buddha. We just think that as we're going to sing this little prayer in Tibetan. The meaning in the mind is to want to offer so that we can receive. It's very marvelous. Okay. Saji paki jokshing metog tramri rablingji ni de genpadi sangge jingdu mikche ulwagi broken nam jag jingla chapasho. And now we request the teachings themselves. You know, Jetsanama Dampa Kienam Kichaku Kala Kense Chutintrik Jita Sampe Dulje Sin Malar Zabge Chuki Chapad Tusong. And now when we say this little Sanskrit mantra, we just visualize Buddha delightedly receiving our offering. Idam Guru Ratna Mandalakam Niryatayami. Okay. All right. Now I forgot the title. Tell me what I'm supposed to talk about, Donna.
I'm an upper mandala.
Oh, good. So sorry. Yes. Go, go, go. How wonderful. So now we're going to actually, this is a visual, this is Mount Meru in the middle and the four continents, okay? We might not realize, but we're, one of those continents is where we are. And the reason the sky is blue is because lapis lazuli is shining, is imagined. So we imagine that. So now that's the offering, the Buddha's body. So we all create the cause ourselves to achieve the enlightened body, offering a statue. Now we offer the speech, which is a text. So we create the cause to have perfect speech to help others. And now we offer stupa, which is offering the enlightened mind. So we achieve that so we can finally be of benefit. How amazing. I forgot to wait till that bit. Now we've done, and then there we go. I should have done a little mantra at the end. I forgot. And I received the kata. Thank you so, so much. How wonderful. Thank you, darling. How auspicious. Thank you. Now, darling, tell me what I'm supposed to talk about. I forget. Thank you, darling. So kind.
So tonight we're talking about, Okay. To ourselves how to develop self-compassion and also how to deal with compassion fatigue.
So. Okay, all right. Hello, Bob, you're there too. Haven't seen you in ages, darling. Happy to see you. Okay, well, that's interesting, isn't it? Our view of this is very interesting, you know. We think we work so hard to help others and we get completely exhausted. And then what we do is we get drained and we have to give it up. Or then we think, well, we should go and have a massage and a nice spa, and then we'll be kind to ourselves and we'll feel better again. Well, nothing wrong with that. But I think it's really incredibly important to understand the Buddhist analysis of the mind, which then can kind of, in a way it's correct, but there's another kind of, you know, the Buddhist view is so distinct. Maybe we've been Buddhist for 47 years or whatever, but unless we really look into the Buddha's really precise way of presenting the way the mind functions. I mean, when we really do, it's kind of, we're going to be very surprised in many ways how fundamentally different it is, you know? So let's just take an example. Let's just think of someone like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, okay? I mean, he should be a great example for us. I mean, he is like the fruit of the pudding. He's the proof of the pudding, isn't he? He's the end result of what we can assume is the practice that he's showing us how to do. We can deduce that he must have done that. So let's look at him. It's a very interesting way to see this, you know? There he is, after 60 years, not stopping since 1959. No, since 1950, excuse me. That's 70 years, okay? Since 1950, when the Chinese communists started moving into his country, he actually hasn't stopped ever since that time trying to get things to work, you know, no matter how bad things got. First of all, they've yet to escape in 59 hard years of work of trying to be, you know, diplomatic with these invaders. Then all the dramas of 50 years since he's left the country, the 60 years since he's left the country. Unbelievable. And we know he has not stopped for one second working diplomatically, politically, socially, scientifically, spiritually, in every imaginable way to try and get things better for Tibetans. And indeed, while he's there, while he's here in the rest of the world, we're benefiting from it, isn't it? So we ought to see there he is. He's the fruit of the pudding. So we think, well, he must have had an awful lot of massages, if that's the case. He must have had an awful lot of spas and massages and weekends off and vacations if he's so happy. But we know it's not true. He probably doesn't have a massage in his whole life. He probably hasn't been anywhere near a spa. And I bet he doesn't take many vacations. So that should blow our minds. We think, well, what on earth does he do to be such a happy guy, you know? And that's a really perfect way to put it, instead of using our assumptions of why we are so stressed out. So one of our first misconceptions is that we think we're tired because we've got compassion. We think we're exhausted because we've been compassionate. This is fundamentally mistaken. And this is where we have to look into the Buddhist analysis, because it's a revelation, because his analysis of what goes on in our mind is fundamentally different. So, okay. The key thing to understand, first of all, we've got sensory consciousness. This is indeed a very powerful starting point. And if we go through our several days together, let's look into this in more depth. But I'll just mention it briefly here. We know perfectly well we have sensory consciousness. We have experiences via our body, our eyes, ears, tongue, the five senses. And we know they play a big role in our lives. As Lama Yeshe says, we make the body the boss, you know. So our physical experiences, they dominate our lives. And already for the Buddha, this is incredibly inappropriate. He's not being fundamentalist. He's not being kind of like, you know, punitive. He's not saying you're not allowed to have nice feelings. I mean, not on the contrary. He just says we misunderstand. We really give so much more power to our physical experiences than in reality they have, you know. There's already a real eye-opener when we look into it in more depth. Then, we have our mental consciousness. Now, that's where all our feelings and thoughts and emotions and unconscious and subconscious. And as Lama Zopa says, that's where the workshop is. If we're trying to be Buddhist, that's the work we're trying to do. Not all the senses. They're fine. Leave them alone. They don't need adjusting. Our interpretation of them needs radical adjusting. So we need to start becoming intimately familiar with the contents of our mental consciousness. Be our own therapist, as Lama Yeshe puts it. I mean, it's a cute phrase. And it's like a good marketing ploy. It is, but it's absolutely true, you know. So we have to learn to know what is going on in our thoughts and feelings and emotions. And this is something we kind of think, oh, yeah, we know that since Mr. Freud, you know, we've been having all this therapy and everything. Yeah, sure. But when we really realize, like His Holiness Dalai Lama, I always quote this, he said, you know, a couple of years ago, maybe he says it quite often, it was these amazing Indians, actually, more than 3,000 years ago, not just 100 years ago, 3,000 years ago, they're the ones who really began the investigation into the nature of self. They're the ones who did this incredible unpacking and unraveling and like mapping of the mind. And I don't mean the brain, I promise, not the brain, but the actual cognitive process itself. And this is why we need to know even theoretically the differences that Buddha makes, you know, the fundamental point. He's not talking about the brain. That's not his expertise. In fact, you ask those great yogis, even before the Buddha, 3,000 years ago, who were the ones who knew their mind intimately, because they're the ones who created that brilliant psychological skill called single point of concentration, and that's the key to it. That's the key to success here. When Buddha diverged in his own direction, directly in relation to his own findings about the nature of self, that's one of the major techniques he took with him, you know? And it's fundamental. So when we really understand that, these geniuses, the way they unpack and unravel the contents of the mind, we're talking about the actual cognitive process itself, not the physical brain, nothing wrong, but the actual internal thing, and that's something we do not have in our culture. We'll look inside, we'll feel things inside, we'll talk things through, but the brilliance of Buddha's skill utilizing this technique is unheard of in our culture, and this is a fact. Not being arrogant, you know. And so like I say sometimes, we just probably thought with Mr. Freud 100 years ago, right, who began the investigations of the nature of self. I'm sorry, no. 3,000 years these dudes have been doing it, you know. And it's only really now in the West that people are discovering this, all these incredible conversations with the Dalai Lama, you know, and so much more of the stuff being published. And scientists and philosophers really looking into these geniuses who've been around for several thousand years. I mean, what do we normally know about India? Absolutely nothing, you know. We love the Greeks, don't we? Nothing wrong with the Greeks. So it's only now we're discovering this. So the Buddha's view of this, the way he analyzes it, the way he even classifies the contents of our mind. And that's the interesting point. Let's look at that. And this is the key to success, in understanding the difference in the way he describes the mind and how it functions. So our mental consciousness, which is all our thoughts and feelings and emotions, right? That's where the workshop is, as Lamazepa says. So this is what we have to become familiar with, right, and know intimately, because why? And this is the first point. Why do we need to become familiar with our mind? We should ask that question, because that's what Buddhism is. You really become a Buddhist when you become your own therapist. So what does that mean? Well, let's look at the word Buddha. This tells us everything, actually. The end result of all this hard work, if we plan to be Buddhists, the end result is Buddha. Look at the etymology of that word. It's brilliant. It tells us exactly what we're trying to do. So Buddha, or the word Sangye in Tibetan, the first syllable, Buddha or Sang, that implies the utter eradication from our consciousness, our mind itself, of all neuroses, all fears, all anger, all delusions, all the miserable parts of us, which we in our culture consider to be totally normal parts of a normal person. So this is already a shocking idea. This is a radical concept. So we have to hear it, because that's what Buddha is saying. This is the end result. But when you've done this job of becoming a Buddha, you will not have one atom of ego, of separateness, of delusions, of fears, anger, you listen to those words that we know so well, they'd be all gone. Now that's mind-boggling. In fact, it sounds demented, but this is exactly what Buddha's saying. Why? Because he has found from his own experience that this stuff is not at the core of our being. It is not at the core of our being. Therefore, it can be removed. Not only that, Sangye, Buddha. The second syllable implies the development to perfection of all the other stuff in our mind. Love, wisdom, compassion, joy, bliss. You don't miss out on that, believe me. This is natural to us. These are at the core of our being. This is Buddha's fundamental point. That's the end result. Now, clearly, if that's the end result, that implies the methodology, doesn't it? That means we need to know what the mind is. We better get what if he says our mind has that potential, we had better know what he thinks the mind is. And if we do, and then we take on board what he says the mind is, then clearly if we can get rid of all the rubbish and grow all the goodness, then we absolutely have to know how to distinguish them. And that's the job of being a Buddhist. That's the job. It's totally internal. And then what the internal informs the external. So, if this is the case, we need to distinguish the neuroses from the virtues, the weeds from the flowers. Let's keep it simple. So this analysis already, this classification of all the contents of our mind into negative and positive states of mind sounds ridiculous to us. I mean, we don't talk like that in neuroscience. We don't talk like that in psychology. It sounds ridiculous. We've got to know what he means by this. So let me ask the question, why should I get rid of anger? Why should I get rid of depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, panic, jealousy, neurosis, paranoia, psychosis? Why should I? Well, guess what, baby? It causes you suffering. But we don't think that. We don't think it causes us suffering. We think someone else caused it, and that's why I'm these things. I'm depressed because she did that. I'm angry because he did this. I'm low self-esteem because she said that. That's our analysis. But yeah, that might have happened. But to the Buddha's view, we've got to get in touch with the actual mind itself, the thoughts and feelings and emotions themselves, no matter what catalyzed it. That's his key expertise. And his simple point is this. The words are so simple, but the job of doing it is the hardest job on the planet. We have to identify the neurotic states of mind and distinguish them from the positive ones. So now, this is the point now. So why do I get exhausted by helping people? Why do I get exhausted when I help people? Well, it's not... So in the first category of states of mind, we call those negative, neurotic, non-virtuous, deluded. In Lama Yeshe's book, Mahamudra, that came out last year, which I really recommend you get, it's a blissful book. It's about how to discover our true nature, how to meditate on the mind and to realize emptiness. It's a blissful book. In that, Lama was so amazing. When he first met Westerners, he just somehow knew how to talk to us. It's incredible. He was born of a hippie. It's amazing. He just knew the words to use. He was extraordinary. And, you know, he came up with about 21 different terms for these neurotic states of mind. This is the first category. The next, never the word that's usually used in the literature. If you read Buddhist books, you're going to come up with the word affliction. It's a very nice word, but a bit medieval. He never used it, because he knew we didn't use it. So these are the unhappy states of mind, the suffering states of mind, the painful states of mind, the neurotic states of mind. We know they're painful. When you don't say, oh, you know, Rabina, I was jealous yesterday. It was just great. Of course we don't say that. We know it's completely horrible. So if we can get rid of them, which is a pretty radical concept, takes a while to even comprehend how or why, and when we study the mind, we learn to understand that, then we better know how to identify them. It's pretty obvious. So why is it so difficult? Because the trouble is, the next category of states of mind, which are the positive ones, the virtuous ones, the ones that are at the core of our being, the ones that do define who we are, and the ones we can develop to perfection, as mad as that sounds. Love, compassion, joy, intelligence, goodness, any of the positive ones, we know those. But in our world, and this is the part that's so troubled, we give equal status, don't we? In all of our models of the mind, in our neuroscience, we give equal status to these as if, you know, a normal person has some anger, some anxiety, some jealousy, some love, some compassion, hopefully more of the nice stuff. We kind of get that. But there's no view that says you can utterly get yourself rid of all the other. That sounds like you're, it's like cutting off your hands. You're like a weird person. You'd be weird if you didn't have anger. You'd be weird if you didn't have anxiety. That's what we believe. We don't question that assumption. Well, Buddha does. It's pretty outrageous, you know. So the trouble is that for us, I always use the analogy of weeds and flowers. It's a really simple analogy. And as we know, when we talk about karma, Buddha uses the analogy of seeds and fruits all the time. So if you think of your weeds, if all your weeds grew down one end of your garden and the flowers and the herbs grew down the other end, you wouldn't have a problem in identifying them. It's very simple, but they don't. They all get mixed together. So when you don't know botany, you haven't got a clue, have you, how to identify a weed from a herb. I always remember one time one of my nephews is a horticulturist. So we were walking one time at one of our centres in Australia, a Chisha centre, and it's in the bush. And for me, the bush, I don't know the bush. I know a rose. I can tell a rose, maybe a daffodil. But, you know, get any subtler than this, I haven't got a clue. I just see this vague kind of green-brown stuff. I'm not being sarcastic. So this particular centre is kind of very flat and looks to me rather barren, you know? Well, my nephew Justin, we were walking together. He was in bliss. Every minute he passed this little red thing and a green thing and a brown thing. He said, oh, this is that and this is that. You can eat this one. Oh, that's good for this and this is good for that. Why? Because he could distinguish all the delicious things because he happens to know botany. Now, we don't know Buddha's botany. I'm sorry. We might know, we think we mean when we know when we say love. We think we understand what we say when we mean, well, what we mean when we say compassion. We think we know what we mean when we say attachment. But Buddha's analysis is so precise, you know. We shouldn't assume. It's really precise. The neurotic, deluded states of mind have a really specific function. The virtuous, positive states of mind have a really specific function, and they're fundamentally different. As you say, in England and Australia, they're like chalk and cheese. They look the same, but they're fundamentally different. And this is kind of, you know, not really the way we analyze them. So we need to understand this. Now, we can assume that His Holiness, they all say His Holiness is the Buddha. I mean, we don't know, we're not clairvoyant, but he's certainly a nice guy. He looks like a good example, doesn't he, of the end result. And the fact that he's a happy guy for 60 years, 70 years, whatever it is, you know, happy guy 60 years, we've got to know what he's done. Well, if he is what they say he is, that means he's done the job of ridding his mind of all the rubbish. He's got no attachment, no ego grasping, no delusions, no anxiety, no depression, no anger. Okay, when he talks to us, he keeps telling us he's an ordinary person. He keeps telling us he gets angry. He's trying to make us feel better, you know? And you know how these Tibetans, they're so wonderful. They're very humble. They never admit to any realizations. So we know that His Holiness or Lama Zopa, whoever, or Geshe-la, they say, oh, I don't know anything. Well, that backfired one time. It was so marvelous. One time in America, Lama Zopa told the story. I've heard it before, too. That backfired. And some guy, an American, was in tears and said, well, Your Holiness, if you don't know anything, what chance have we got? So he kind of backstepped a bit and said he did know a few things after all, you know. It's very sweet. But, I mean, if he is the end result of this path, and everybody says he is, if he is a Buddha, it means he has no ego grasping left. He has no fear, no anxiety, no attachment, no jealousy, no depression. He has infinite compassion, infinite wisdom, infinite love. We've got to hear these words. If this is a real path, not as a blind belief, if it's real work that you can do and that's the real result, then if he is that, then we have to deduce if he's rid of delusions and he's rid of attachment and anger and fear, that's why he's a happy guy. No matter how much, I mean, he should be out of his brain with misery if we talk about compassion fatigue. Helping us old auntie or our crazy kid. Can you imagine he's helping out the bloody world? Sorry, don't swear here. Americans don't say that word, do you? I remember on the phone one time to one AT&T lady, I got angry and I said bloody. She practically wanted to sue me, you know. I said, well, that's just a normal world in Australia. It doesn't matter. It's normal. Anyway, the thing is, if he is the end result, That means he's done the job of getting rid of delusions, and that's why he's a happy person. That's why he doesn't get compassion fatigue. So, of course, it's a bit much to expect that we can get rid of it overnight. But if we understand this theoretically, it is a revelation. So we know that the steps we have to take. In other words, we don't suffer because we have compassion. We don't suffer because we have love. We don't suffer because we work hard. We don't suffer because we have attachments and anger and fears and jealousy and depression. But don't think that's a criticism. It's identifying our disease. We should have compassion for ourselves. But our trouble is because this is so-called religion. As soon as we hear we've got a problem like anger or attachment, we kind of feel like we're being attacked, you know, and it's my fault, I'm a bad person. We do that interpretation. It's a revelation. It's like when you go to your doctor and she tells you the food that you're eating is wrong, that's why you're sick. You don't feel she's accusing you. You thank her so much for her that she's identified the problem. Well, that's what Buddha's doing. He says to us, oh, guys, I'm sorry, you suffer because you've got attachment and because you have anger and because you have jealousy. And the methodology in Buddhism is methods to identify those and gradually, step by baby step, lessen them and grow the other stuff, you know. This is the job. This is the job. So given there's going to be quite a few lifetimes, unless you give up sex, drugs, and rock and roll today and go to the mountains and meditate day and night, it's going to take a while. That's okay. The journey is long. It doesn't matter. We've got a map. We're comfortable. It's okay, you know. Be patient and humble with ourselves. But when you know what the goal is, you know what the steps to take. If we don't know what the goal is, how do you know what steps to take? So we know the goal is Buddha. Then we know the method. We know the steps. It's very clear, you know. That means we have to learn to identify the delusions, because they are why we suffer. They are what freaks us out. They are what makes depression itself, anger itself, attachment itself, anxiety itself. This is a really hard job. The words are easy, you know. But to do this job, it's difficult, not because it's technically difficult. It's because we're addicted to not doing it. We're addicted to thinking it's other problems, you know. That's the problem. So given the fact that we have got attachment and jealousy and depression and low self-esteem and need our 8 hours of sleep or whatever it is, and, you know, rests and spas and massages, not criticizing. Given that we do that, then we pace ourselves, obviously. We pace ourselves. Like anything you're learning to do, you pace yourself. You have to. That's intelligence, you know. But we have to know how to identify a problem. If we've got a problem, and we know very well, the first step is to identify the problem exactly. And then you have to identify the causes. That's a crucial step. You can't go past that. Once you identify the causes, that implies the solution. So we call it compassion fatigue. Let's call it getting exhausted from working so hard. You know, seeing suffering all the time. We understand that. You might have a suffering kid. You look at the world now, people are suffering. You know, ourselves. And we see that. So we get exhausted from that. But we've got to identify exactly which part of our mind is causing that exhaustion. We've got to look at know the pieces of our mind. And this, you see, isn't our approach in our culture. So let's look at our approach. Because we've got the philosophical materialist view that prevails in our culture, isn't it? That's the view that we all have, that we take as the truth, that mummy and daddy made us, that we track ourselves back to mummy and daddy, that our mind is the brain. We are the physical world. We are physical. We have chemicals and genes and DNA. And we do have all those things, but, you know, that's not the whole story, Buddha says. Then the very strong belief we have, which is the basis of our world, the basis of our views, the basis of our psychology, that we're products of the external world. And that our experiences, that we're product of mummy and daddy, and they're also a product of what people did to us. So the nuns at school treated us nicely, the people treated us badly, and whatever. We always look at, so our approach to locating the cause of our suffering, we look into the outside world, naturally. If I'm angry, why are you angry, Rubina? It's because Donna was mean to me. My friend Donna was mean to me. Nobody's going to question me when I say that. We'll understand. Why are you happy, Rubina? Oh, my friend Donna's so kind to me. We don't question that. And this is something very powerful. This concept alone is so powerful. We don't question that. It is true, and Buddha doesn't argue with it. But his difference is this. He says, yes, Rubina, aren't you fortunate? Donna was so kind to you. That's an incredible thing to happen. So the person can be kind to you. It is definitely one of the causes of your happiness. But honey child, it's not the main one. So he adds this extra thing. He doesn't argue with that and throw that out. He doesn't say the outside world doesn't play a role. He doesn't say the brain doesn't play a role. He doesn't say the body doesn't play a role. No, he adds this extra component, and this gives it the dimension that enables us to understand his view. He's not saying that Donna being mean to me isn't one of the causes of my suffering. It's true, it is. But he adds this extra component, and he says, the jealousy in your mind when Donna goes out with someone else instead of me, for example. I think Donna's action caused my jealousy. I think Donna's generosity caused my happiness. But he's, the way the Buddha would put it, and this is the perfect way to put it, those things out there, Donna's actions, they are merely catalysts. Catalysts. They're secondary causes. When you study Buddhist philosophy and psychology, you learn very detailed all the kinds of different causes, direct cause, indirect cause, substantial cause, many kinds, and they're very precise. We need, it's like technology. You need to understand them precisely, you know? Excuse me. I have to blow my nose. I'm so sorry. Wait. I took a long time to do the setting here. It was like a theatre, you know. The lighting, and I'm in Santa Fe now. I've been in Portland for 9 weeks, and now I'm in Santa Fe. So that client Charmaine gave me her house. We spent like an hour trying to do the lighting, this, that, the statue, all the colours. Now I've just messed it all up. I even got little blue things on the floor where we put the chair. Now I've messed it all up. I had to have Buddha for you, you see. It's very nice to have Buddha, isn't it? Okay, back to our point. So, okay, the Buddha's point is this. It is a fundamental, from here to Buddhahood, this is a fundamental point in Buddhist philosophy and psychology. Buddhist psychology, and then when we understand karma, which is Buddhist philosophy, that the main cause of our experiences, it's a very simple statement for Buddha, the main cause of our experiences, the main causes of my happiness, the main cause of my suffering, the main cause, not the secondary, not the catalyst, the main cause, is what is one, two things. Well, forget the karmic one now, but the first one is past actions, but forget that one. What's in our mind? That's it. What goes on in my mind, Buddha says, is the main cause of my happiness and my suffering. It's a very simple statement, and it's a pretty shocking statement. In our materialist world, if we do all these conferences about what happiness is and what are the causes, and then we identify 27 varieties of happiness, and then we have eons and eons of discussion about what it exactly is and what causes it. Well, for the Buddha, it's extremely simple. Happiness, we either have in our experiences in our daily life, we either have happy feelings or we have unhappy feelings. Think about it. From the time you are born, think about it. Think about it. This is a powerful point. So he can remember. We have pleasant feelings or unpleasant. So this gets us to the third category, by the way. Buddha classifies all of our millions of states of mind. He identifies 84,000 alone, 84,000 neurotic states of mind. And he identifies 84,000 antidotes to them. They're the virtuous ones. But luckily, he narrows them all down. They subsume to three, don't they? The three poisons. Ignorance, attachment, and aversion. And we've got to understand these to understand this question about compassion fatigue. We're getting to all this, okay? So, we've got the neurotic states of mind, which are the voices of ego, if you like, that constrict us, that narrow us, that make us miserable, which we can get rid of. We've got the virtuous, positive, reasonable states of mind, which are the third part is interesting. I like to call them the mechanics of our mind, and it's very powerful. What they are the things we all know very well, like concentration, good memory. There's one called discrimination. There's many of these, many. And these are like the mechanics. If you're a murderer or a meditator, you need concentration, no question. If you're a sniper, you know, you need a good, very good concentration, very good discrimination. Discrimination is happening every millisecond, and it's the ability to distinguish between this and that. Well, you need to have very good discrimination to be a sniper. A hawk from 1,000 feet up knows exactly where its breakfast is, you know. So you've got to have good discrimination, good concentration, good this, good that. And these are happening all the time. They're there in the background, causing us to function properly. So, one of those in that category, meaning they're neither virtuous in their character nor non-virtuous, and that's kind of real meaning in Buddhist psychology. One of those is actually called feeling, not the way we think of it as a synonym for emotion. No, there's only three kinds of feeling. pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Well, let's forget the neutral. Who cares those? But think of our lives. This is quite a revelation, actually. Think of our life. If you look from the time you can remember up to now, if you thought of all your experiences, all the people you've known, and you'd put them into the cat, and the feelings that you've got as a result of contact with those things, contact with food, contact with objects, contact with people, you'd divide them into pleasant feelings, and there could be a spectrum, some very blissful feelings to some mildly pleasant feelings, or you have unpleasant feelings. Let's face it, isn't it? Think about this. Now, what are two other words for those? Guess what? Happiness and suffering. That's it. Happiness means feelings, means a pleasant feeling. But we are so addicted, this is what's so interesting, our analysis in our culture, we're so addicted to believing it's our materialist world that Donna is the main cause of my happy feelings. Then what happens is attachment kicks in, we're going to discuss these points and these states of mind, these are the crucial ones to finally understand. Because of my hunger, this emotional hunger inside me, one of the main neurotic ones, this constant neediness to get all the, to get only the nice things. So when Donna says nice words, with my name in them, of course I'm going to get a very pleasant feeling. And then attachment kicks in and then grasps onto Donna and begs her to say it again, if you like. Look at the chocolate cake. You have contact with chocolate cake, attachment makes it look totally delicious, and it does trigger a pleasant feeling when you put it in the mouth, no question. So we make we deduce the cake is the cause of the pleasant feeling. Wrong. It's only a catalyst. I assume Donna's pretty words are the cause of my pleasure. So of course I'm a junkie to get her to do the words again. Of course I am. This is just touching on what, we can go into more depth. This is like the technical explanation of happiness and suffering. So all our lives, look at it. We can either divide into pleasant feelings or unpleasant. And guess what? Attachment's job, the junkie in us, is to get the objects that we are convinced will trigger pleasant feelings. We spend our life doing that. And then we avoid all the other ones that trigger pleasant, unpleasant feelings. This is how we spend our life. This is a samsaric method for getting happiness and for stopping suffering, for getting pleasant feelings and stopping unpleasant feelings. Because happiness is not Donna's words. We believe it is. You know, if I have a really good day, oh, how'd you go today, Rena? I had a lovely day. I'm so happy. Tell me what happened. And I will tell you all the external events, won't I? The pleasant weather, the nice food, Donna's lovely words, the gift from a nice person. I will give you a description of the external events and things because we are convinced we almost conflate them with the feeling of happiness. We've got the wrong analysis, Buddha says. Wrong analysis, sorry. So happiness is a word for a mental state, and through our senses as well, yes, but it's the consciousness, it's the mind that experiences pleasant feelings, happiness. Not the cake, not Donna. She's a catalyst, yes, but we're so addicted to believing she's the cause, we're literally demented, you know, Buddha says, we've really got the wrong end of the stick. We misunderstand every single second. Pleasant and unpleasant feelings, happy and suffering, that's it. So now, let's look. When I go to work, I have to help sick people. How incredible that you've got to go off and help people. How amazing you go off and you have compassion and you're helping people. It's incredible. But the suffering is overwhelming. It is overwhelming. Look at the suffering. All the recent stuff that's happening with demonstrations, people dying, people this, suffering, COVID-19, the world's chaos. We can go mad looking at all the suffering, can't we? So we've got to be another tickle. Which part of me is causing me to go crazy? This is the point now. Of course it's hard. His Holiness, if he is what he is, if he is the end result of this path, which they say, all the lamas we know will tell us he is a Buddha, he's done the job, he's the real deal. If he is, it means, you've got to hear this, he does not have one atom of ego grasping, not one atom of attachment, not one atom of anger, not one atom of anxiety, therefore, and panic. Not one atom, not possible. This is mind-boggling to us. That means he's not unhappy. This is what's so bizarre. When we assume seeing suffering people is why I'm unhappy. No. So why am I unhappy? Guess what, folks? It's because I've got attachment. So what's attachment? It's the junkie in me. Don't be criticized by this. This is our disease. We should be paying Buddha $1 million. We just got the lottery, you know. Attachment Okay, they've got the 84,000 neurotic states of mind. Okay, Buddha's got this whole map of the mind. And the Hindus were the ones who first mapped it. Buddha's got his own variation of it, but essentially it's all been done by these genius Indians in their own mind. I mean, we think we're so arrogant in our culture. We really do believe it was Freud, you know. I mean, 100 years ago, it was so pathetic, you know. Anyway, get my point. So, 84,000 neurotic states of mind. It's very fascinating. But we all know they all subsume three poisons, three toxic emotions. And of course it sounds so cute to us. This is his analysis of why we suffer. This is his analysis of why we suffer. And why we do bad things and harm other people. Why the world goes crazy. This is it. But it seems too simplistic to us. Because we put it into the pot called religion, and then psychology is sort of serious and over there, you know, we just don't understand what it is a psychologist. That's his expertise, you know. So attachment. So the three poisons, the summary of all the 84,000. And interestingly, Ning Rinpoche, has he been to Raleigh? The young Ning Rinpoche. Have you invited him to come? Haven't you? You better. There's the reincarnation of His Holiness's Root Guru. And he's going all over the world now and teaching. You know, he speaks perfect English. Young, he's like 30-something. Got his Geshe degree. The reincarnation of Ling Rinpoche, the senior tutor to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who passed away in the 80s, you know. And the root and the guru of many of our lamas. So, Ning Rinpoche now travels a lot, and many people tell me they've not heard this before, and I've never heard it before either. It's very fascinating. You know, as we know, Buddha states there's 84,000 neurotic states of mind. It's an entire map of the mind, you know, it's a detailed map of all the neuroses. So, these three, subsumed of the three, ignorance, attachment, and aversion. So he said, 21,000 of those 84 are rooted in ignorance. 21,000 are rooted in attachment. 21,000 are rooted in anger. And the final 21,000 are rooted in all three. This is a really profound, sophisticated map of the mind. I mean, it's really amazing, you know. And then, of course, Buddha asserts 84,000 antidotes to each one. It's a really precise presentation of the way the mind works and how to stop suffering. It's extraordinary, you know. So, these are pretty primordial. And these three, we can understand these three. And this is for the rest of our teachings. This gives us the insight, profound insight into the workings of our own mind. So we can understand these three. So all the others stem from it, you know? Because these are the root of our suffering. So how? Okay, ego, there's a hierarchical relationship between these three, okay? The ego grasping is the root one. As we know, ignorance, maripa. Unawareness, okay? Unawareness, maripa, the main delusion. And known colloquially, which is very tasty, as ego grasping. It gives rise, it's the root one, the one that clings to the neurotic, mistaken sense of a separate, ridiculous self. It's the one that is finally annihilated, the delusion, when we realize emptiness. That's the way to go, you know? So on the basis of that one, which is just running underneath everything all the time. But mostly it's like a sleeping lion. Now on the basis of this neurotic sense of a separate, miserable me, we have this primordial attachment, which is this multifaceted, neurotic state of mind, you know, and this is effectively the main reason for suffering in day-to-day life. And that's really abstract for us if we think about materialist views of saying why we're suffering. And as Swami says, I can tell you about attachments for one whole year. We will never begin to understand it until we start doing the work deeply inside, you know. We want to start with the theories, you know, what it is. So, attachment. Attachment, what is it first? And the third one is anger, okay? I'll explain that in a second, the three. And they're directly related to each other. So, attachment is this, it's multifaceted. The most primordial kind of energetic level of it. And this is from practicing in countless past lives. And we've got to take this as our view here, Buddha's view that we've come into this life programmed from practice of all these things. That's why we're so good at them. You know, they're second nature for us. So the most subtle level, most energetic level, automatic level of attachment, the symptom of it, is dissatisfaction. Primordial feeling of never being enough, never having enough. No matter what I get, not enough. No matter how many times Dawn told me she loves me, never enough. No matter how much food I get, never enough. It's this bottomless pit of dissatisfaction. And as long as that says it's the main disease in the West, there's no question. So this is the energy of attachment, the deepest one. So obviously if I don't have, I think I've got enough, I have to hanker after something to fill me up, don't I? Pretty obvious. So the first level of attachment is evident, it's the objects of the senses. And that dominates our lives. The assumption is that when I get that object, Donna's nice words, the delicious cake, then I'll get happy, then I'll get satisfaction, then the pain will go away. This is the overt workings of attachment, you know. So it's just junkiness, speaking very simply and very kind of, you know, a bit shocking. It's basically a junkiness every second, working overtime under everything we do, say, and think. And virtually it's at the level of assumption. And its assumption is that I, the fantasy I, frantic, fear-based, panic-stricken, I must get what I want every millisecond. So another way of putting that is, attachment is a junkie that can only bear the nice things. It only wants the nice thing. Why? Because it'll trigger a pleasant feeling. So it's a junkie to get only the nice things. And that's our method of getting happy, isn't it? So you discover that chocolate cake triggers a pleasant feeling, so attachment has to make sure it gets the chocolate cake, gets the right words from Donna, gets the right thing, gets the green light and not the red light, and it's watching every second of the day at a profoundly subtle level. We've got to start somewhere with it. So this is our method for getting happy feelings, isn't it? So when attachment, but what happens when attachment can't get what it wants? When it doesn't get the object that will trigger a pleasant feeling, or when it does get the object that will trigger a pleasant feeling, and the attachment is the junkie that thinks if I have another piece of cake, I get another pleasant feeling, well, we know it eventually turns into unpleasant feelings. Whichever way we go, it ends up with unpleasant feelings. So we're caught. We don't know what to do, you know. So, or it'll say, I'm wanting Donna. I'm dying for Donna to love me. I'm dying for Donna to say lovely words like she said yesterday. And suddenly she criticizes me. What occurs then? Third one, anger. Oh, my God, who do you think you are? How dare you say that to me? So it's a panic attack of when attachment doesn't get what it wants. The third delusion is called, bare bones, is called aversion. So if it's at the volatile level, that's anger. At a milder level, it's upset, irritated, annoyed, frustrated, stressed, worried. All of those are mild versions of aversion, mild versions of thwarted attachment. And we have these all day, but we don't pay attention. You go to your therapist and say you got annoyed today, she will laugh at you and tell you to go home and stop wasting her time. She only wants me to go and see her when I want to kill Donna. And that's our problem in our culture. We don't think we've got a problem until we want to kill somebody or kill ourselves, because we don't pay attention to the deeper levels. And this is Buddha's expertise. So here we have attachment running under everything. It even, and this is the point, we've got compassion. So, you know, let's say you're helping a friend who's very sick or neurotic or whatever you like. So you've got the other category of states of mind. These are our saving grace, compassion, love, empathy, kindness, generosity, forgiveness. Thank goodness we've got those. Without those, we would be a psychopath, quite simply, quite literally. They're our saving grace. So there's the person who's got a headache. Say my friend has a headache, and I have compassion. I see her, and I go, oh, poor thing, she's got a headache. You know? No, there's a better example, a person close to you, like your brother. Let's say he's an alcoholic, okay? So you've got the attachment, and your aversion, and the neurotic state of mind. They're there all the time, doing their trip, depending on how advanced you are, or how not advanced. But on top of it, you've got a compassion. It's there too, right there next to it. You've got the weeds, and then the flowers are there too. Now, compassion is one of the flowers. Compassion is empathy that sees your brother and sees that he's suffering. Your heart goes out to him. You love him. You want him to be happy. You have compassion for him. You want him not to suffer. No question. So now, this is now we're getting to why we get exhausted by helping people. This is now we're getting to the exact answer. And it's not what we think in our culture. So there's my brother. I have such compassion for him. But what I don't notice, and this is the point now, it's very depressing to hear it. What I don't realize is that the attachment in me, this hunger, this frantic neediness in me to only have the nice things, to only have the pleasant experiences. So that part of me is being very offended. I don't realize it, but that part of me is what's causing me to be stressed. My attachment, when I see my brother sick, and an alcoholic, and then I see him come home and vomit in the soup and make mummy and daddy unhappy, then I start to get upset and angry with him. So I've also got compassion, but my attachment that only wants nice things, what it does, it's like a mother for her child, we all recognize it, that's a part of me that manipulates, that mixes with my compassion and manipulates him to do what I want, because it's very offensive to my attachment, but he's not making me happy. It's very distressful. I get angry, I get upset, and I do not get angry or upset or for compassion fatigue because of compassion. My compassion is empathetic. It has, it's a virtue. It's a valid state of mind. What causes me suffering is the amount of attachment that's mixing with the compassion that is desperate to feel good. And because he's not making me feel good, for sure. He upsets mum and dad. He's a hassle. I think about him all the time. We talk about him behind his back. And the attachment in me is this junkie that wishes he would change. So I don't realize that I'm manipulating my brother like crazy. It's like, we all know with our mums, you know, not being rude. Mummy was a fierce attachment for us. Oh, I told you because I love you, she says. And we know damn well it's not because of that, because they're interfering in our life all the time. But attachment only wants everyone to do what makes us happy. That's how attachment interferes with other people. It sticks its nose in where it doesn't belong. But we think it's because of compassion. So I'll go see him. I'll tell him about AA. I'll give him different books to read. And then I'll see that he's not following it. I'll get angry. And then I'll stick my nose in again. And then I wonder why I get exhausted. And I think I get exhausted because my brother makes me tired. Because my brother is so sick. And therefore compassion is not helping me. So I think I've got compassion fatigue. No, you haven't got compassion fatigue. You've got attachment and aversion. That's why we suffer. It seems so cruel to say that. Because suffering is real. People really do sacrifice their lives for others. Look at the people who are working, dying from COVID by helping other people with COVID-19. It's incredible. But if you suffer because of it, it's because we have attachment. It's not being rude, you know. It's a revelation that we should want to know our mind and be kind to ourselves. And then, of course, have a sleep. Have our spa, have those things, but so being kind to ourselves, compassion to ourselves isn't just having the spa, isn't just having the massage, isn't just having a holiday. It's necessary, but we've got to give up attachment and give up anger. That's the long-term job. That's the method for being compassionate to yourself. And that's the method for never having compassion fatigue. That's the long-term view. But within the fact that we've got attachment and got anger and got anxiety and got fears, we have to adjust ourselves and recognize them and then, you know, adjust our behavior accordingly. You can't be like Lama Zopa who sleeps all night. He never sleeps. He meditates all day and night. I can't be like that, so I've got to adjust my behavior, aim for that. I can't be like His Holiness right now, who's only compassionate, only wise. But you aim for it. But you have to see the problems in our minds, distinguish the pieces that are making me miserable, be kind to ourselves, and adjust my behavior, and have a good weep, and have a good sleep. And then wake up next morning, remember compassion, and off you go again, you know. Are we communicating here? It's not the analysis we use, that's all. It's not our analysis. And our trouble is, because it's like religion, you know, it's as soon as we hear that Buddha says we're the problem, our own anger is the problem, we start going, you mean I'm the problem? We get guilty, we think he's beating us up, we hear it as punitive, we hear it as punishment, you know. It's not like that. We misinterpret it, you know. Just like when you go to your doctor, and she, why am I sick all this time? And she gives you the answer. You really feel you've won the lottery. You didn't realize, because you were ignorant, that the things you were eating were causing you suffering. You don't accuse her of bullying you. You don't accuse her of punishing you with cancer if you keep eating that food. You thank her for her kindness. You know it's going to be hard work to give up that food. But it's a revelation. You now know why you are suffering. That's our approach here, you know. And it's the hardest job we'll ever do because it's not our analysis. We know all the theories, you know. And this is why, I mean, we've been trying to practice together for 40 years, let's say, you know. And we all know in the Buddhist centers. I go around to all of the Lama Zopa centers. I'm not being rude about us. We all have problems. I accuse Donna of saying this, and she said I did that. And, well, forget all the theories go out the door, don't they? It's all Donna's fault. How dare she say that to me? We forget the analysis. It's so hard to take responsibility. It's so hard to realize it's my attachment to my anger that are the problems. Yet Donna might be a creep. She might have done some mean things. That's not being argued with. I mean, you know, with politics, like we all love to love or hate Mr. Trump, isn't it? Maybe some Trump supporters there. I don't know. Maybe you don't confess to it among your friends, but you understand? Some people, doesn't matter, I'm not being critical, I'm not being partisan. So especially such a polarizing person as Mr. Trump, you know, let's say you have a view that you hate Mr. Trump. So the fact is, I remember, like His Holiness said one time, he said, I might not like George Bush's, President Bush's politics, but he's a very good man. That's a possibility. So, you know, you can distinguish between the politics and the person. It's okay, you know, and even now people, if they compare with Mr. Trump, they think he's a saint. Now people think George Bush is a saint now, practically, you know. So what I'm meaning is this is the whole point now. This is the point. So you know the analogy of the bird needs two wings. I use it all the time as a way of framing all of Buddhist teachings. So here we're talking the wisdom wing, wisdom and compassion. And the wisdom wing is the nuts and bolts of understanding karma and understanding your mind. That's the Theravadin level of the practice. That's the first and second strokes of the Lam Rim. I call it junior school and high school. This is the work we have to do on ourselves for our benefit. So we can become a marvelous person. So we can then do the compassion wing, which is help others, you know. To the extent to which we don't know our own minds and don't know our own attachments and don't know our own feelings, when our compassion is profoundly limited, really limited, you know. So the world is horrible. Bad things are happening. You know, people are looting. The policemen are killing people. These things are happening. They're true. And you analyze it, it's not cool. Donna might be mean to me. She might have said those bad things. That's because I'm trying to change my mind doesn't mean Donna's really a saint after all. Just because I'm trying to not be angry doesn't mean that people aren't looting and people aren't shooting. They are. And that's why Martin Luther King, I always quote Martin Luther King, he was incredible. You could tell that he was a patient fellow, you know, you could tell he was patient. But how courageous he was, look at him. And he said, it's good to find fault. It's good to say, look at the suffering, look at the racism, look at the sexism, look at the poverty. It's good to say that. But then he said, then you say, what can I do to help? That's compassion. That's compassion wing. But the wisdom wing, I find it very powerful when I read all, you know, my newspapers and things. I read my iPad now. I don't touch any newspaper anymore. I used to be so attached to newspapers. My favorite newspaper was the New York Times. So I used to get onto airplanes, and my favorite shopping was in the bookstore, because I'd go on these airplanes, right, to go to the centers. And I'd have 5 pounds of newspapers. And I'd love my newspapers. And then iPads came along. And I was sad to miss my newspapers. But now I look at a newspaper, I said, so I'd never go to a newspaper. I never touch a newspaper anymore. So I have all my things online. Of course I have on my iPad. So when I read my New York Times and my Washington Post and my Vogue and my Vanity Fair, I still do, and all my different papers, getting all my stories and things. You know, I read about the world all the time. I'm just reading about the world. Now the thing is, this is a really powerful way to look at how we can see what's happening in the world without being kind of freaked out about it, without getting compassion fatigue. It's a really powerful point. So the wisdoming approach to practice is working on yourself. Seeing your own mind, taking responsibility, recognizing your attachment, recognizing your anger, recognizing your anxiety, recognizing your depression, that they are my problems. That's the wisdom wing. So every time you look at the world, then if you're using the wisdom wing approach, so when I read the papers, let's say I read about Mr. Trump, and I hear that Mr. Trump lies, and I hear Mr. Trump is arrogant, and I recognize there's hubris, arrogance, lying, jealousy, you know, whatever you like to call it, partisan, whatever you want to call it, observe those things. Now, normally with attachment and anger running the show, what happens is this. I'm attached to someone with my viewpoints. I'm attached to getting what I want. I'm attached to reading about a person who says what I like to hear. Isn't it? That's how we are. And the moment I read about a person who doesn't agree with me, the moment I read about a person who's doing bad things, then my anger takes over. How dare he do this? Who does he think he is? I mean, half the raging on in all the papers these days in the world is shouting and yelling and screaming at Mr. Trump, let's say. Well, in the end, what good does that do? It makes you more upset. Talk about compassion fatigue. So what's the analysis? How do you look at the world with the wisdom wing? Okay, I read about Mr. Trump. I read about the suffering that's going on now. I recognize lying. I recognize stealing. I recognize hubris. I recognize arrogance. I recognize partisan. I recognize all the delusions. I tick all the boxes. And then I say to myself, are there two things? I recognize that. I recognize jealousy. I recognize lying. I recognize arrogance. I recognize anger. I recognize attachment. So I say, I recognize those. In other words, when I read about Mr. Trump, I don't, you know, anger, who does he think he is? How dare he be this way? We always do this, as if we're some kind of perfect saint, you know. That's called anger, because he's not doing what my attachment wants. But if you try to practice you go, I recognize that. And then the other one I say is, thank you for showing me how not to be. So you make it practice for your mind. Then you will not get angry. You will not get stressed. You will not get compassion fatigue. You will not get fear. You will learn about it because you know this is the world. This is the suffering, crazy world. And the more you understand karma, that informs this is the look at the crazy world. Look at delusions. That is why people are suffering. This is why people are suffering. With attachment and anger and jealousy and arrogance and pride and dementedness. And that's why we do things with our body and speech, because let's face it, our body and speech are the servants of our mind. They do the crazy attachments, wishes. They do the anger's wishes. So then, with that approach, knowing your own mind, knowing why you're suffering, Mr. Trump is not the cause of my suffering. He is the catalyst that triggers my attachment and my anger, which they are why I'm suffering. This is a logical, valid analysis. But we do not like it. It doesn't mean Mr. Trump suddenly is a saint. No. He might be doing exactly what people are accusing him of. He might be. When you understand karma, you know why he is. So then this is what stabilizes our mind. Then you won't lose the plot. Then you have compassion. That eventually comes. Because if he is a bad person, and if he is really doing harm to others, then you have, in the end, you'd have compassion for him. And you would not have that until you do the wisdom with yourself. It's like a compassion that a mother has for her child. Everybody else can't stand that junky kid. The brother. He's a pain in the bum, you know, he vomits in the soup, but his mum has such compassion for him because she can see he's harming himself. That's the basis of compassion. The Buddha has such compassion for all sentient beings because we are harming ourselves. We are the cause of our own suffering, and we can be the cause of our own happiness. This is what Buddha is saying. We know the word backwards and upside down, but how hard it is to practice. Because why? Because we're addicted to the other one, that's all. So it takes time, you know. So when you don't get angry and you don't have attachments, you will not suffer. It's a fact. That's like how His Holiness is not suffering. He will try and tell you he is, just be like us, you know. He's not. His mind is in bliss the whole time. That sounds very weird. I mean, every day his Tibetan people, still after 60 years, coming over the mountains to Dharamsala, and he's in tears when he sees them. But that doesn't mean he's suffering. He's got compassion. Compassion does cause you suffering. Compassion causes you, gives you the bodhisattvas to have courage to never give up helping others. Yeah, you need a good sleep. Have a good sleep. Nothing wrong. Wake up next morning and keep going. But it's attachment and anger and anxiety and depression. They are the source of our pain. I'm not trying to say we should be saints overnight. We can't. This is a long-term goal. But we've got to identify the cause exactly. Otherwise, you'll never find the solution to the end of suffering. Ever. As long as until the cows come home, you'll never find the solution. Now it's time for questions. Come on. All of you guys. Ask any questions. Any old question you like. I don't care.
So there's no question in the chat here right now. There will be another check and see if we have
any. All right, good. Well, I'm sorry. I've got to go off again. I've got to get my drink. I'm so sorry. I wasn't quite prepared. So while I'm going for 1 second, if you can, I've been abusing you for 1 hour now, so you can calm down for a second. See if you have any questions, okay?
Okay.
1 second. Have a breather, okay?
All right, there's a student who says yes, and when you come back.
So questions now. Let's have discussion, okay? It's the best part.
Okay.
Okay. Hello, yes. Mary.
Donna, can I ask a question?
Go for it.
Okay. This is Kim.
Hello, Kim. Go, darling.
Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah,
virtually.
Yeah, that's right.
So, and I hear you saying if I'm doing the wisdom wing work, then when I see Mr. Trump on television, and I realize all the things he's doing, I say, you know, this man is harming himself. I should have...
Well, first of all, then, but the key, Kim, is you've got to first... This is the key. You have to see every one of those delusions are in your mind. First, you see that. So do you have to recognize attachment. You have to recognize anger. You have to recognize arrogance. You have to recognize depression. You have to recognize lying. You have to recognize jealousy. Do you recognize any of those words, Kim? I mean, you're like the rest of us. You probably do recognize them, even small levels of them, don't you? So that's the point. He might be a bigger version of it or less. That's not the point. But you recognize, guess what? I've got those. I recognize attachment. And then you go, thank you for showing me how not to be. Then compassion can come then. Before that, you have to do the other stuff first. You've got to know. And that's what gives us connectedness to others. The arrogance that says, how dare he do that and I'm so perfect. No wonder we get angry. Like I'm a saint, we all know that's not true. And this is where we've got so much hubris. We love to point fingers. We know this. And that doesn't mean he's not doing harm. It doesn't mean that. But you only have compassion after you've seen your own delusions and after you've had compassion for yourself, Merit Kim. That's the point of what renunciation means. It means I am sick of this suffering. This is why I'm suffering. And of course, if you have a view of karma, you know any suffering that happens to you in this life is from doing actions like that in the past based on these delusions. So you've got to have that for yourself first. Then compassion will have a basis. Compassion is not enough, as Paulina says. You've got to have wisdom. Meaning well is not enough. And our trouble with compassion also is we only have understanding for the first kind of suffering. Compassion is seeing someone suffering and having empathy. Well, the only suffering that we can identify in the world is when the bad things happen. That's the first kind of suffering. But the second kind of suffering, which is all the suffering of the delusions. We've got to recognize those in our own mind, Kim, and be vomiting at the thought of more of them. Then we have a sound basis for understanding Mr. Trump and having compassion. It's got to go one step at a time, soundly and rounded and proper. Then you can be useful. Get out there and demonstrate. Absolutely. Do you understand?
I do. My hard part is when I see Mr. Trump is harming himself, but he seems to be harming a whole lot of other people, too.
Of course he's harming everybody else. Of course he is, darling. Who says he's not?
But it's confusing because then I have compassion for all the people that he's harming.
Of course you don't.
And wishing that he wouldn't.
I know that, but why are they being harmed, Kim? Who caused their harming to them? Who caused them to be harmed, Kim?
Probably they're, in part, their past karma.
What do you mean, in part?
Well, I mean, if
you have the Buddhist analysis, Kim, the only reason Donna is kind to me is because I've created the cause for her to be kind to me. The only reason Donna is mean to me, and this is another whole discussion, this is a discussion about karma, which is fundamental. Without that, there's no understanding why Mr. Trump is harming himself. Of course it's not. Go back to this. In your life, have you ever had an argument with somebody?
Sure.
Have you ever harmed somebody?
Yes.
Okay. And what was it in your mind when you harmed them? Was it love or was it attachment? Was it kindness or was it anger? Which one? Which one caused you to harm them?
It was anger, for sure.
Thank you very much, baby. Now you understand Mr. Trump. It's so simple. Until we've done that work ourselves, Kim, we won't get it.
Uh-huh.
Do you see my point?
Yeah, I do.
We might be smaller versions of it, but until we do the analysis and know my attachment itself is pain, and then because of that, I do things to harm others. So the only reason we harm others is because of our delusions and our attachment. So and that's the point about karma, Kim, in the very first level of practice. We're talking high school here. We're talking middle scope of the lamb rim. Junior school is karma. And that's why the very first entry-level junior school grade one practice, as Lama Zopa said, is at least right this second, stop killing, stop stealing, stop abusing, stop harming, stop lying. Why does he tell us that? Because guess what, Kim? Those actions now will ripen in the future as exactly those things happening to you. So when we make that connection first, then we understand karma properly. But in our Western culture, we do not like karma and we just gloss right over. And that's why we just don't know how to interpret the world.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why, so the first level of practice, they call it renunciation. That's what compassion for yourself is. In other words, if you've been drinking alcohol for so long, or you've been eating too much sugar for so long, you have to get to the point where you are revolted and fed up and exhausted by the suffering. But you have to recognize you've caused yourself the suffering. Mm-hmm. And that is what energizes you to get past it. And then you can have compassion for the others just like you. Mm-hmm. You've got to do the work inside yourself first. You've got to be sick of your own junk and your own suffering and your own misery. And any bad things that ever happen to you, you know it's for the karma. And anything you do, and this is the analysis we have to do. That is the sound one of the wisdom wing. And then it's easy to interpret the wackos and the psychopaths and the pedophiles and the wackos in the world. And it won't make you crazy. You'll have even more compassion. But compassion isn't sentimental, Kim. Compassion is tough compassion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just always watch where I quote that story when I was in New York in 2003. And Richard Gere invited His Holiness, and he decided to do some work with some, you know, former prisoners. All of whom had done some kind of meditation in prison. So he invited like 20 former prisoners, and he invited people like me who were working with people in prison. It was a very moving day. They met His Holiness, had these incredible discussions, talking about all their suffering in prison, you know, all these Americans, cross-section of Americans, right? And then he also invited two young Tibetan nuns. So now, think about this. The view of karma, which is new to us, we know it maybe theoretically, but not very well. We don't study enough, you know. It's a vague kind of notion. We don't have much clarity about it at all. Mm-hmm. And because it's not the world view, we almost feel embarrassed to say we talk about karma, because we keep it quiet almost, because it's just too weird for us, you know. It's not really that very deep in our bones. So the view that's in our bones, we know, is that mummy made us and caused the suffering that's caused by the things out there. That's what prevails every day. That's what we see every day. That's what we buy into every day. That's what ego thinks. So then these young women, karma's been their view for 1,200 years in their culture. That's the default view that they're all brought up with. They don't even question it, like we don't question materialism. It's just the default assumption in their mind. And they understand it deeply, and they study it deeply. Now, this is the point that's shocking to us, Kim. They were telling their suffering, and I think of those Americans probably were thinking about, because they'd been sexually abused and tortured in prison for a couple of years, right? Now, I'm sure if the Americans are sitting there, they probably, if they wanted to quantify suffering, they could argue that maybe those young women's suffering was worse than everybody else's. You could argue that, perhaps. But it was very evident that these young women were not angry. And that's weird for us, but let's analyze that, please. Anger. Look at, and we're going to discuss it as we go along in the days. Look at the philosophy of anger. Look at what anger says. Anger is the outrage when my attachment didn't get what it wanted. So my attachment is the junkie in me that only wants nice things to happen. So naturally I get angry. And don't misunderstand anger with strong compassion and wanting to change the world. That's good. Don't think, like Martin Luther King said, when you say, what can I do to help? Don't think that's anger. Anger is self-centered. Anger is obsessive. Anger is thwarted attachment. Anger is only I, and it is outrage. So what does anger say? How dare they do that to me? How dare Mr. Trump do that? That's anger. Now, it's very hard to talk this way, because we conflate anger with strong compassion. We think if you give up anger, you've got to say, oh, well, the poor police who killed that guy, he can't help it. That's not true. That's not compassion. That maniac policeman who we observed for nearly 9 minutes, killing a person slowly, it looked like the poor man. I mean, this is the point now. I'm going off track for a second, these young women, but I'm getting to the point. That it was evident to anybody that this guy is quite mentally ill. I mean, we wouldn't say he's mentally ill, but he's mentally ill. If for 9 minutes with a cold demeanor, he can kill a person. He hardly looked like he blinked. Everybody on the planet could see this. I'm sorry, that's a psychopathic mind. And psychopathic means deeply deluded, deeply demented, distressed, demented human being from strong delusions. Are you hearing me, Kim? His mother, she would never hate that boy. Her heart would break seeing what he's done to himself. That's the point about real compassion, because he's harming himself. Of course he's harming others. Now, anger is this, how dare he do that? What a monster he is. And he is. It was horrible what you saw. But when we understand our own minds, Kim, when we all understand our own attachment, our own anger, our own neurosis, and I mean deeply understand, we will understand why he is like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we'll understand why he did what he did. So these young women, they didn't have anger, Kim. So what does anger say? Anger says, how dare they do that to me? I don't deserve it. This is a whole other analysis we have to talk about. the assumption of the assumption of attachment is this incredible entitlement that I only deserve good things.
Mm-hmm.
And when anger comes, it's this outrage that anybody should do anything to harm me because I don't deserve it. Now, where does the philosophy of attachment and anger come from? From no sense of cause and effect, from no sense of karma, from being an innocent victim. I didn't ask to get born, my mother did it, it's all their fault. That's the arrogance and hubris we live with. It's a completely faulty philosophy, Buddha says. Now, those young women didn't have that philosophy in their bones. They had the view of karma. They knew the causes of this, so they didn't have the question, how dare this happen to me? They didn't say those words. So at the end, there were tears. And then one of them said, very quietly, and of course we had compassion for our torturers, because we know, of course, we must have harmed in the past, them in the past, and because we know they will suffer in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a hard one for us to have. That's not how we think, and it needs not just superficial knowledge. That's deep internalizing it. If you buy into that view, no one has to. I happen to be a Buddhist, and I decide I'm going to look into this stuff seriously and try to put my money where my mouth is. It's a really tough one for us. It's a huge point.
Mm-hmm.
This is, so unpacking and unraveling all these assumptions is what being a Buddhist is. Of course, it's not easy. We've got to be pretty ruthless with ourselves to do this.
Mm-hmm.
You with me?
Yeah. It's just, I have to practice it and practice it and practice it.
And they've got to study it, Kim. This is technical explanations of things. It doesn't come just from a feeling, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Can you understand my point?
Yeah, thank you.
Because it's intense. And you know, the thing is, if George Floyd, George Floyd, if his brother came to me, I would never say these words to him. I would hug him and agree with him. Because this word, I'm wearing a Buddhist group here, and so you've asked me to talk about it, I'm sorry, I'm going to talk about it, you know. So I wouldn't just blurt it out, oh, well, yeah, he deserved it. I would never say that. It's a big picture view, you know, it's a powerful big picture view.
Yeah.
But those young women, it's very shocking to hear that from the only Americans. It's very shocking to hear that view, but they can see the evidence of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was genuine compassion. That's, their view was completely different. It's such a superficial word. This is primordially deep stuff, you know. Fundamentally questioning all the assumptions we've got. It's quite a tough one. And of course, no one's forcing us. We don't have to be Buddhist if we don't want to. It's up to us.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand?
Yes, thank you.
And this is an interesting point. Another example. As soon as we hear give up anger, we think we become wimps. No! I mean, there's the other story. Another Tibetan friend, Jigdol, years ago. He was part of the big kind of first mini uprising, really, in Tibet since 1959. It was in 1987. So nuns. So we think, well, that's interesting. They must be angry. So he was telling me about the suffering. He'd escaped eventually. His brother got murdered. Father got murdered. His friend had his head blown off. I mean, he'd been imprisoned himself. He'd been abused, tortured. He escaped. And he was telling me about it. And I said to him, Jigdol, do you ever get angry? And he laughed. And he said, angry, Rebecca, what for? It's our own fault. Those words are outrageous for us, right? He meant, in other words, karma for him is in the bones of his being. It's not some superficial belief he shoves into his mind. It's just a view he has that informs everything he experiences. So he said, of course, why should I say, how dare you do that to me, I don't deserve it. He knows why it's happening. But that doesn't mean he doesn't get out there and demonstrate and risk his life.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't contradict. But we think it does. Because we think anger is just, you've got to have anger, we think, to function. No, look at some of the people even now, the ones looting and the ones who don't loot. What's the difference? One, someone got morality and ethics. I'm not being rude about looters, but we say, oh, the poor things, they can't help it. Rubbish. You only loot because you've got a chance here to steal.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean you're a good person or a bad person. Even if you're black or white, it's still you've got a chance here to steal. But we go, oh, the poor thing, they can't help it. They've been poor all their lives. No. Some people don't loot. Some people are not angry even. Some of those policemen are even putting down on their knee and having compassion, you know. So it's much more nuanced than we think it is, this analysis of the mind that Buddha has. Do you understand?
Yes, thank you. Hi, good morning, Lena.
Who's that?
My name's Sinead.
Hello, sweetheart. Talk to me.
I have a question.
Good morning.
So it's about the way that emotions can affect the physical body and
heart. Yes, absolutely.
So I was trying to reflect a little bit on it while I was listening to the other answer, and I understand that part of this karma and all of it was the three poisons of attachment and aversion.
Yes. Yes.
And ignorance, and primarily ignorance, I suppose. So I'm wondering if there's a practice that helps you unfold the emotions that are deeply stuck inside the body. I don't know how to explain it.
It's like, really a very big topic, Sinead. Let's just talk about it, for example. Let's talk about it. But let's just do, again, the Buddhist analysis of the relationship between the body and the mind. This is very fascinating, okay? It's a very good analysis. And this is a system that, this is from the Vajrayana teachings, okay? But this is a system that the Tibetan medical system uses. It's similar to the Chinese one. Similar to the Ayurvedic, the old-fashioned system of talking about the four elements. Do you understand? So the Vajrayana, so okay, we're made up of the body, and we've got, in the Vajrayana model, we talk about gross consciousness, which is the day-to-day sensory experiences based upon this gross body. That's the first level. Then we have subtle consciousness and subtle physical energy. And that subtle physical energy in the Vajrayana, which is the basis of the Tibetan medical system, we've got 72,000 subtle channels throughout the body, and then coursing through those channels are all these different subtle wind energies, prana. And this is, I mean, they studied this stuff for 12, 15 years. It's really quite sophisticated understanding. Of course, it's an old-fashioned view. We used to think that back in the West in the early days. We have all these other elements now, but this is still a valid system. So these are four elements, and these wind energies are coursing through all these different channels, and this is the interesting point of the Vajrayana. They're all inextricably linked to our different states of mind. So your Tibetan doctor will feel your pulses, and she will feel a real imbalance of particular winds, and she knows that's directly connected to your attachment, which is having panic attacks. Panic attack is the mind gone berserk, and that, so when your mind is attached and panicking and anxious, that pollutes those wind energies, and that's why you have a physical experience. If she'll feel the pulses where you've got strong wind imbalance related to your anger. Look, I mean, when you're angry, look at the violence of the, it's like you're having a storm inside your body, isn't it? Because the mind and these winds are intimately connected. It's a really sophisticated explanation. So the Tibetan doctor, seeing, and she'll even see the karma as well, but she will give you certain herbal medicines that will calm down the wind energies, which in turn help calm your mind down. It's a very profound system, but extremely subtle to understand. So it's obvious the physical and the mental are utterly connected. Now, our trouble in the West, this is very serious, we don't notice we have got problems until our body feels it. So that's really like, for me, I use the analogy, and it's a dumb one, but it's a good one. It's like you've never heard of car mechanics and you've got this beautiful new car and you've never heard of mechanics and you drive it and drive it and drive it, never noticing the wheels beginning to wobble, never noticing problems because you don't pay attention. And then eventually at 100 miles an hour on the freeway you suddenly go, uh-oh, my wheels are falling off, and it's only you notice it then. That's us with our mind, Sinead. We don't notice until the body feels something because we're so obsessed with our bodies. But meanwhile, it's going on in our mind much deeper. Every single day, you get a bit annoyed. It puts imprints in your mind. Every single day, it builds up until one day the wheels fall off, but we don't pay attention when the wheels are wobbling. We know you're going to make your car never have wheels fall off. We could do the same with our own mind. We have to learn to pay, and it's a good skill, to pay attention to what's happening well before it gets to become physical. The physical is the grossest tip of the iceberg. But we're so obsessed with the body, and we're so obsessed with feelings, we simply don't notice the subtle level of our mind, which is all the conceptual stories underneath happening 1,000 times a day. We don't, this is the wheels wobbling. We just don't pay attention. That's why it's always so dramatic, and that's when we think we have to go to the therapist. It's just too late. It's way too late, darling. Do you understand?
You do, and the question arises that a practice, if for say it's reached the physical body, say that the problem has reached the physical body, and there's like a confusion of how to take it back into the emotions and back into the subtle body.
I don't understand all that. That's not the point at all. That's not the way to say it. You don't do that.
Okay.
So what's your question? So say the question again. Given what I just said, now ask the question again.
It's about practice, about the
best. So practicing what, Sinead? Okay, stop. Let's say you're on the freeway and your wheels are falling off. So at that moment, what do you think you're practicing? At that moment, what's your practice? At that moment, what's your practice?
Stop driving.
Well, just do the best you can. Damage control. So that was while I'm in the midst of shouting at my boyfriend, that's the wheels falling off. And the trouble is that's the only time we ask the question, what should I do when I'm angry? It's too late to ask what will I do. You learn, luckily if you save yourself and don't die, your real practices go back to basics. Start controlling your body and speech. Live in vows. Do your practices every day. Control your damn body and speech. And then you begin to see your mind every day before the wheels fall off. That's the learning from it.
Mm.
That's it.
Yeah.
Do you hear me?
I do.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you, darling.
Thank you for being here.
That's a pleasure. Mm-hmm. I wish I were there. I wish I was at Robbie's house. He's my husband. Where is Robbie? Is he here? Did he come? There he is. Robbie, you got my room all nice. I can't hear you. Put your thing on. Talk to me. He's my husband.
Very lonely without you here.
I'm sure you are, darling.
I'm walking around upstairs.
I hope you've cleaned your carpet. I bought the carpet cleaner. Have you cleaned your carpet since I was there? He's not answering.
Yeah.
Hello, Robbie. I'm coming next year, okay?
Great.
Any more questions?
We'll hold you to that.
Thank you, darling. Any more questions? He's not my husband, Roman. No, I don't have a husband. I don't want a husband.
I have a question, Venerable, if no one else does.
Andrew. Hi, sweetie pie.
So sometimes when I am meditating and I work through bodhicitta and compassion and I work with whatever I can understand with emptiness, I begin to see this sense that I'm just playing these tricks on myself. Like, I can see how my desires and my afflictions are really just sort of creating my own pain.
That's right.
But it feels almost too easy. It's like, ha-ha, I could just stop doing this and I would be happy.
That's right. You're right, then. You're right, then.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess my question is how to develop the faith to really let go of all of that.
Okay, darling. That's not really the right question. If you had just begun playing tennis and your Federer is your coach, you don't say, how can I just let go of not playing tennis and just play tennis perfectly? You would never say that, would you? Ever. You wouldn't say that, would you?
No.
What would you say instead? How would you approach it?
How can I begin to hit the ball properly?
And you start at the thing, you just learn. You don't go, there's an idea of letting go. It's a very powerful concept, but it's like a bit sort of like magic. It just doesn't happen like that. You just don't sit there on the court going, I've just got to let go of ego and I'll be able to play tennis perfectly. Bullshit! You've got to learn slowly the steps. Do everything Fatima tells you. Hit the ball, do this. So that means control your body and speech. Don't kill. Don't steal. Don't lie. Live in vows. Keep your refuge commitments. Do your practice every day. It looks boring, but this is you're building the groundwork. And then you get to this. You first control your body and speech. If in one day you can shut your mouth and not say one bad word, you are practicing the backhand properly. But we forget all about that. We go garbage, vomit out the mouth and criticize politicians all day and then think about emptiness. You're missing the point. Control your body, control your speech, and then you begin to control your mind to see how disgusting delusions are, and you practice every day and every day and every day, slowly, 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 and you'll then gradually. But it's really tough work each step of the way. Don't ever think it's not, and delight in the practice, but have it in order, go the step by step. But this idea of letting go, it's all very lovely, but it's a bit sort of nonsense, really. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. I think I'm, and I definitely appreciate that. I think I'm not formulating what my real question is, but I don't know that I can.
Well, then kindly say to me. What's your real question, Andrew?
I don't know. There's a way in which feeling the possibility of that sense of good and happiness, there's a way in which it's hard to accept.
What's hard to accept?
That things can be that...
See, so it's hard to accept you can be the Dalai Lama.
Well, I don't know.
That's what you're saying. Here's an example. He's your Federer.
Yeah.
So keep it on the earth, Andrew.
Yeah.
You've got Federer in front of you, showing you what you can damn well become, and you're so arrogant you think I can't do it. Why do you think that? That's just stupidity. You've got a hand, you buy a racket, you can hear his language, you've got legs, you get feet, you follow all the steps, and you will become like that. It is logic, not mystical, Andrew. It's not crossing your fingers and hoping for the best, which is what people think of religion. It's bullshit. I'm sorry to keep swearing. You just follow the steps one at a time and be humble. And you've got to recognize, and that's why it is inspiring to read the experiences of Federers, the experiences of the yogis, that when you read in the Buddhist one about the nature of mind is pure, understand that logically. Then you'll have confidence and you go one humble step at a time.
Yes.
Are we meeting again?
I believe so, yes.
Well, I'm very pleased. But just keep moving, honey. But you've got to get the instructions clear. Do what Federer says. If the Dalai Lama is the result, surely you've got to go, well, I wonder what he does. I better follow his instructions. Well, guess what? We've got his whole family. All the lamas talk, Geshe-la talks like this way, any teachers you have. Here's an example. They've all done the same thing. So let's follow the instructions, Andrew. Don't make it mystical. I mean, they're showing us in front of us, staring us at our face. what we can become. And they've got the system there. They've got the map there. They've got the techniques there. Don't try to sort of reinvent the wheel. Just follow the instructions and relax and then rejoice in your good qualities. And the results will come. This is logic. Are we communicating?
We are. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Who else? Anyone else got questions, Donna? Paula? Anyone else, Donna?
No one else has a question here.
All right. Anyone else got questions? Yeah, Mary. Go, Mary, sweetheart.
I keep coming back. It's so good to see you.
Yes, Mary.
Trying to say, look at, like, the what's happening in the United States with race and all the people who are suffering.
Yes.
And, you know, I really have come to believe in karma and understand to, you know, that it's a long journey and, you know, how many I've been and how many I may be. Mm-hmm. But I had such a hard time with, I think it's my Western mind, you know, Catholic, former Catholic, that
sure.
All the people who are suffering, like groups, say people from the Holocaust,
yes, sir.
Or for all of the Black Americans and who are suffering,
yes,
it almost seems like I can go, well, to think that it's collective karma,
mm-hmm.
It's just really hard.
What? The collective part is hard, is it?
Yeah, like to say, I mean, cause it almost seems like, well, I don't have to feel, and it goes back to what you're saying today, tonight, too. I don't have to feel as badly as I think of it is that I can still work to help and show compassion, but that's their karma. I don't have to take on their pain.
See, this is the interesting point. Because, you see, the only reason we respond to karma like this is because of the assumptions already present in our mind. And because the assumptions, and those assumptions are that we're made by our mother and father, we are only physical, and we began in our mother's womb. That's the assumption we have. At such a subtle level, we don't even think we have it. We assume, so when you have that as a view, and then suddenly we hear that we experience the fruit of our past actions, so then we assume, oh, well, you deserve it. This is the logic for us. You see, when we have compassion, we have only got compassion for innocent victims. We've got to be innocent before we have compassion because we don't have any sense of cause and effect. But when we have the bigger picture all the time, and the other point is this, when we have the bigger picture that there are countless consciousnesses going back countless lifetimes, going forward into countless lifetimes, and one lifetime we have good experiences and bad experiences, and each one of us is the cause of both of them. So even if we think about good things, this is even the more shocking point, Mary. In one day when bad things happen to you, in 99% of the day good things happen, but the only time we say, why did that happen is when the bad thing happens. So what does that tell us? We take the good for granted, which means that's attachment is an assumption. It's really this entitlement. Attachment is this junkie in us that just assumes good things should happen, and that we don't care if there are causes. In fact, we just think we're born and we deserve good things. There's no logic to that. That's like thinking, you look in your bank and you see there's no money there, and you say, why are there no dollars in my bank? I deserve dollars. What do you mean? You know it's your bank, and what's in there is what you put in it. So there's no view that you deserve. You see, when you say deserve, there's an assumption that someone's supposed to give it to you. But the Buddha says we give it to ourselves. This is a very different view. So when we have the view of karma, then every time something good happens, you'd be bliss, in 90% of the day it was good, but you'd be so happy when someone smiles at you in the street. You go, well, that's a pursuit of my past virtue. Then you'd be happy if you walk into the bank and they give you credit. That's incredible. That must have been so generous. You'd be happy when the food nourishes you. That's amazing. That's the fruit of not killing. You'd be blissed out. And the one little bad thing that happens is it's like nothing. You brush it off like a fly. Oh, well, there's a bit of a bad thing happening. So when you own the good things first, we never ask, why do good things happen? We are outraged when the bad things happen. And we all have to be innocent victims. And we have all these wrong assumptions in our mind if we compare them with the Buddha's view. But this takes time to internalize. It really takes time to unpack them all. Not to believe them, but to think them through and look at the experiential consequences of them.
I can see it sort of for me, because I remember from one of your teachings about 7 years ago that you said, and it relates to my living circumstances.
Yes.
And I swear every day I look out back and and think about what you said, that
there
I'm very blessed. I'm so blessed.
There you go. But blessed, you don't look in your bank and say, aren't I blessed? What would you, when you see the dollars in the bank, or if you have a garden, you've got lovely veggies and flowers.
If
you ever say, I'm blessed having this, you would not. You'd say, look at that amazing garden, and you'll never forget for 1 second that you planted it.
Well, that's what I mean.
Oh, I'm lucky, I'm so blessed. Rubbish. You'll own it all and feel so blissed out, and then you'll remember that every time you eat the cauliflower, you'll make sure you plant another one.
Yeah, but I do think of it that way. That I do.
Good then. That's amazing.
I do.
Because own it. You own it. You own it.
A while ago, but it's hard for me to grasp the whole group.
The group is no problem. Do you notice we do things in groups? Do you notice we identify with groups?
Yes.
Well, then, we do things in groups. We experience them in groups. It's pretty obvious. Same. Do you understand?
Yeah, it's just,
what's the problem with groups? Why have you got a problem with groups?
It's just...
But I mean, there are groups. I mean, no, wait. You have to look at the cause. It's a group of people, due to generosity and non-killing, are born in a city where it's clean. That's due to environmental karma, where the food is delicious. That's due to non-killing in the past, where the food is delicious. Mm-hmm. Then secondly, it's all clean. That's due to no sexual misconduct in the past. Then you leave your door open because it's due to no stealing in the past, no one steals from you. There's causes every piece of it. So all the people who've got that karma, they all get born in that environment because they created the cause of that environment. That's called group karma, Mary.
Mm-hmm.
We don't ask why good things happen. It's only when it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
So you do things in groups. So if you've got the karma due to past killing, and past arrogance, the rebirth you get, you created it in advance. You're like, you booked a place in the lion realm, and you run to a mummy lion because that's exactly the body you created. You created the cause to have that kind of mind. You created the cause to have that environment. We create the cause and we run to that mummy. We create all that. So if you've got generosity karma, you get born in a rich country. If you've got non-generosity karma, you get born in a poor country. You'll find exactly your right environment, exactly the right group. You'll meet each other. Hi, guys, we all did it together. It's not so complicated. Karma's a natural law. No one runs it. It's not punishment, not reward. It takes care of itself.
Okay.
I mean, of course, it's not easy to think about, but all we can do is talk about it. All we can do is... think about it. And the Buddha's speaking a load of rubbish. We'll find out one day. It's okay.
Yes.
Do you understand?
Yeah.
Yes. Who else? Donna, anybody? How long have we got today? 2 hours or 90 minutes?
2 hours. So we've got about 30 minutes.
Okay. All right, darling. So any questions, anybody? Anything at all?
When are you coming back to Australia?
Oh. She's in New South Wales. What time are you there, darling? God, you must be in the middle of the night.
It's 10:30 in the morning. I had...
Oh, yeah. It's a reasonable hour, isn't it? That's right. Well, no, I'm supposed to come back in August. But they'll make me sit in a hotel for 2 weeks. They give me forced quarantine in Australia. They're so strict. The whole of Australia's only had 104 deaths, you know. They've got 25 million people. They've really been strict. 104 deaths in total. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, they come and quarantine down here.
I know, they put you into a hotel and you might get a cheap motel, you might get the highest. There you go. We'll see what happens if I come back then. Any more questions, anybody? Nothing else?
Yes,
Katie.
I'm sorry. I'm very, 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 very new.
Oh, no, it's all. We're all new. Don't worry about it. Just say what you want.
Do you recommend a specific concept to start with, or a specific material to lay a foundation of understanding?
Of all the stuff we're talking about, you mean?
Yes, today, or just Buddhism in general?
In general. There's so much material available these days, as you know, So I think a really good start. I mean, what have you read so far? What books have you looked at all? You can say even.
I do have the In a Nutshell book, and I have some of the, and of course now.
Yes.
It's packed up. I'm getting ready to move. I cannot remember the authors, but I have some. Yes. Some books where some of, they're basically giving advice and how to look for things.
Yes.
Would it work? I think is one of them.
Where are you moving to, Katie?
Just down the road.
What city do you live in?
I live in a small city outside Raleigh called Clayton.
Oh, okay. So you haven't been to the center in Raleigh yet? Is it too far away for you?
No, I've been there to purchase literature.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, darling, listen. So already here you are even now. We're already here. You're here at this class. You're hearing these things. So, you know, so just keep reading what you've got. It's like anything. If you first go to your first tennis match and you get all excited and I love tennis, you've got to follow your own steps. Then you've got to start looking for more tennis clubs. Then you've got to start going online. Then you start reading it. Then you start taking classes. So you just keep moving, Katie. Read the books you've got. Look at the bibliography. Read another book. Go to another class. Check this out. There's masses of stuff online these days. So much stuff you can do. You know, so just follow it one step at a time, Katie, reading what you read, and slowly, slowly, like any big system, you'll start to find your way in it. Initially, it's a bit confusing, but just start where you are and keep moving, Katie. It's the best piece of advice I can give. Use your common sense. There's a lot of rubbish published out there because, you know, it's quite popular in the West, and because we think we can write what we like and make up stuff, but I mean, it's, you know, you really check your sources. You know, anything about the Dalai Lama, you can't go wrong. Anything that you're reading at the moment and stuff in this center, the center in Raleigh, they're a good source for valid material, valid classes. So just follow your heart one step at a time, honey, and keep following it. And as you keep moving, it'll become gradually, the pieces will start to fall into place. That's my best advice. You know? Trust your own heart. Trust your own intelligence.
Yeah, it's going a bit over my head right now.
Of course it is. But don't worry, even if you get 1% of what we're talking about, don't worry about it. You get a sense of some, talking about the mind, you kind of recognize some of the stuff. You understand? Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Keep moving, one step at a time, Katie.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Guys, thank you.
Good. Someone else? Any questions, people?
Gloria, go ahead, please.
Okay, can you hear me?
I have to find you, I want to see your face. You got a face there?
I don't have a face. Can you hear my voice?
I can hear your voice, darling. What's your name?
Gloria.
Gloria, talk to me.
Thank you so much. It's so great to see you. I got to see you the last time you were in Raleigh.
Good, Gloria.
So based on your recent comments about karma, I'm really curious if you have any thoughts about what sort of karma Donald Trump might be reaping at this time.
I understand. So put it this way, okay. There's a very nice thing. This is a bit shocking.
Ravina?
What?
Ravina, can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm just about to answer Gloria. Who's talking? Who was that?
It's Andre.
What are you trying to say? What do you want to say, Andre? Andre, what do you want to say?
He's gone away now.
Okay, I won't be long, Andre. So listen, Gloria. Okay. First of all, this is a bit shocking to hear. I'm going to tell you this. This is the way you should look at the world. The Tibetans have a saying, you don't know who anybody is, so don't judge. So let's just forget Mr. Trump. Just think of anybody next door, your mean brother, the ex-boyfriend, all the people we don't like in the world who maybe have harmed us. It's a really powerful view, first of all, to be able to separate, to try and just, okay, put it this way. Just if you see behavior. So you're going to see, let's just say Mr. Trump, and we see certain behavior. So behavior is the body and speech. And then
I think it's okay.
What, Andre? What's happening, Andre? You've turned your mute off, darling. I can't hear you. Andre, what are you saying? Unmute yourself, Andre. Can you unmute yourself, Andre? Andre, sweetheart, talk to me.
I've unmuted him, Venerable.
I know, he's not talking.
No.
Andre, sweetheart, why don't you talk to me? What's happening? Talk to me later, Andre. Or do you want to talk now, darling? Talk later, Andre. Oh, answer Gloria first. Can I answer Gloria first and then I'll talk to you? Do you want to talk to me after Gloria?
No, it's on. I'm having a problem with Zoom.
Can you hear me or not?
I did.
But you can't hear me so well now.
Yes, my Zoom is off.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm trying to talk, but my connection is not good.
I can see that. I can see your voice is delayed. So if you really, what are you going to do about it? Can you fix it? Can you make it? Are you close to your modem, Andre? Are you close to where your modem is?
Okay.
You've got to get really close to where the modem is. That makes a big difference. So you've got to go fix that. What, sweetheart? Can you talk to Donna? Donna, can you talk to Andre personally and see if you can help me fix it?
Yeah. Andre?
Can you talk to each other privately, please? And see if you can help him get close to his modem. That makes a big, big difference. Believe me. And I'll answer Gloria's question. I'll talk to you. Donna will help you, Andre, okay? Just turn each other's video off as well and just talk to each other, please. Just a second. Can you do that, Donna? See if you can help him. Get close to the modem is the main thing. Okay. So, Gloria, are you there still?
I am, yes.
Good luck. Okay, so let's just look at behavior. Let's just leave the person's mind alone. And what we see is behavior. So let's look at the behavior at the moment. It does look like, isn't it, we see arrogance. We see all these things. Would you agree with that? We see bad behavior. Would you agree?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, good. So then this is the point. So if you think of those actions, this is why if you're studying nutrition, you look at it very impartially, don't you? You see what you see the symptom, you know the cause, so you give advice. So if we see lying, then the result of lying is that you get lied to. I mean, the long-term result in Buddhism, of course, is lower realm suffering. Forget that one. But one of the direct results of lying is that you will never be believed. Look at that in our life. We have that sometimes, even if we're telling the truth. That's one of the karmic consequences of lying. The karmic consequence of arrogance is you'll end up being born in a really poor place and no one will respect you. The consequence of anger is that everyone will hate you. Think about that. If you look at the action, you can pretty much deduce the result. Do you understand what I'm saying, Gloria? It's a very logical kind of thing. Do you understand?
Yes.
That's the way to think about it. And that's why at the very beginning of practice, when most of us, we decide we want to first start living a good life and not lying and not killing and not stealing, the Buddha's saying the main motivation for that is because we've got to recognize that we create ourselves. This is a real powerful point behind all the teachings in karma. We're not the product of someone else. We're not made by a creator. Mummy and daddy didn't create us. They gave us a body. But our own consciousness comes from the past, and then we continue to carry out those habits. So we're born in this life with the wish to tell the truth. That's incredible. We're not just lucky. That's because we've got the habit to tell the truth. If people believe us when we speak, that's because we've told the truth. So we can see the direct result right now. So then it gives us more inspiration to want to keep telling the truth and not steal and not lie and not kill. It's not because someone said we should. It's because we create ourselves and we create our own experiences. That's the real key behind the approach to karma. It takes a while to get it. Do you understand what I'm saying, Gloria?
I do. I think maybe what I have a hard time with is I see him in a place of power.
Yes.
And maybe that's just a society.
No, that's a really good point. Let's discuss that one. Okay, Gloria. The key to understanding that is this. In the Buddhist analysis of karma, maybe at one of our other days we're going to go into more detail, that our past actions ripen in four distinct ways, okay? So the first one is our own rebirth. So in our case, we've got a human body, all right? And that means, you know, due to our past virtuous actions, we've got a human body. So forget that one. The next three, we can see it, are all ripening in this present life. Now you think about it. The next three are this. The next track, it's like four tracks of karma. The next one is your mental tendencies. So you can see, we use an example of a person. You see they have a tendency to lie, a tendency to steal, a tendency to rape, a tendency to kill, a tendency to be good at music, a tendency to be good at football. We can see we've all got personality traits, haven't we?
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand, Gloria? So we think in the West that we become like that because someone does something to us. No, Buddha says, you come into this life programmed with those habits because you've done them before. That's the first kind. You get born with your tendencies. You get my point, Gloria? First one.
Yes.
Now, the next kind of karma is called your experiences, really, at the hands of others. Now, that same person, they might have a tendency to tell the truth, but because of another past life karma, they've got the second kind of karma, which is called the experience, similar to past lying, where people will not believe their words. So you can be telling the truth, because you've told the truth in the past, but because of another lot of telling lies, that ripens as an experience of not being believed. Can you see what I'm saying? Can you hear that?
Yes.
So Mr. Trump, give an example. People tell us, we all know the newspapers, some of the newspapers track and say he's done like 5,700 lies since he started. So let's just say he does lie. Let's just say he does, okay?
Yes.
You see? That he's born with a tendency to lie. Now, the fact that there are millions of people who believe Mr. Trump, would you agree with that?
Yes.
Those people, like 50 million Americans who adore him, or whatever the number is, I don't know the number, they have the karma with Mr. Trump from some past lives, 47 lives ago, where they believe him because of some past time when he told the truth. So with those particular people, no matter even if he's lying, they believe it. So you are believed by people because you've told the truth, but you lie because you've told the lie. But they're separate. One is an experience and one is a habit, and they're from separate lifetimes. They're not linked to each other. Can you hear what I'm saying?
I hear what you're saying. I don't completely understand it, but I hear it. I'll chew on it.
You can't understand. You can't understand different karmic imprints ripen at different times. We've got to take the view of karma that your consciousness comes from before. That's just the hypothesis here. You get that point, don't you?
I do.
There are millions and millions and millions of seeds in our mind from all the past habits we've done. You with me there?
I am.
Some of them ripen as a tendency, Gloria, and some ripen as an experience at the hands of others. They're two separate things. That's why bad things happen to good people, and that's why good things happen to bad people. So the experiences you have are from one lot of karmic seeds, and the tendencies you have are from another lot of karmic seeds. You with me?
I am. I'm trying to follow you. I've never heard
all I can do is tell you this.
But it makes sense. It makes it.
So, you know, for example, some people love Mr. Trump, and they respect him. That's from him being humble in the past. Other people hate him and think he's arrogant because we've all got different relationships with many different people over many lifetimes, Gloria. I mean, it's really quite complex and it's quite fascinating because it's everything anybody ever says and does and thinks, and it stays in the mind and then ripens in these different ways, you know. And it's all just its own law. No one's running it. No one's running the show. It's not punishment. It's not random. It's not reward. It's a whole kind of different kettle of fish, you know. It's very fascinating. And another one of the days, I'm sure we're going to have to talk into it in more detail, okay?
Great. Thank you so much.
All right, darling. Okay, Gloria. Any other questions, Donna?
Yes, Lauren Bell, you can unmute and ask your question.
Have we sorted out Andre?
Well, Andre left the room and came back in, so he should be...
He's got closer to his margin.
Yes, I think so.
Good. Good, Andre. I'm happy.
We have a question from a student who's talking.
Yeah, goodbye, Andrew. Happy to see you later, darling. Happy Andrew's leaving. Goodbye. Francis, yes. Who's the next person?
Hi, Venerable Bina.
Hello, Lauren.
Hi. Long time no see.
Absolutely. What's your question, darling?
My question is that I'm having issues. Sorry, it's a very emotional question.
Oh, darling.
I'm having issues learning to accept and properly love and show compassion for one of my sons who has special needs.
Say that word again. I'm a stomach. I want to hear you exactly. What did you say, sweetheart? You're having trouble?
One of my sons has special needs. And
that means what? Explain what you mean by that, darling. Explain what you mean.
He has autism and epilepsy.
Yes.
And he has a lot of anger issues.
Yes.
And I find it very difficult to not be angry with him and show him the compassion and love that I feel like I should.
I understand.
So I understand the karma. There was karma aspects that led to this. But I'd wonder if there's a meditation or something I can do to
help. It's just plain karma work. First of all, I have to ask you if you're doing everything possible physically for him. Have you emailed me, haven't you?
No. You gave me my refuge on last week on Thursday.
Oh, darling, of course you did. That's right, Lauren. So this is why. Why don't you email me about this as well? Because there's lots of things that I think also we don't need to talk about it now, but other factors we should discuss. I think I'd like to discuss it with you.
Okay.
I don't know if you've discussed that, darling. But in general, let me just take your question generally, because it's a good question for everybody, whatever the situation is. When a person we are close to, who is very difficult to deal with, is what you're really saying, aren't you, darling?
Yes.
Of course, it's enormously difficult. This is whether you go to work when you're helping people, or whether it's your own son, whether it's your boyfriend, whether it's your mother. Everybody has a variation of this type of experience. So it's really, really hard work, Lauren. So one of the things is, of course, there's no quick meditation, there's no quick fix, it's learning to work on your mind and get better and better and better at it. But one of the things that I think we often don't consider, and sometimes it's very hard, especially if you're a mum, we need to give ourselves a certain kind of condition where you have some space, where you have a break from it. We are all human. I mean, if you're Dalai Lama, or you're like Lama Zopa, he sleeps, he does not sleep, he doesn't need to. We're not at that level yet. So we need to give ourselves certain conditions. So to expect your boy, first of all, to expect your boy to be better than he is, you can't expect that, but you absolutely have to find a way where you get space from your boy. Are you able to do that or not?
No.
This is a big problem. This is where it's almost inhuman to expect yourself to be perfect and never get angry and never get distressed. You've got to find a way, Lauren, no matter how hard it is. But we often just, then we beat ourselves up because you're not perfect and then you get guilty. It's not appropriate. This is where we need to have intelligent self-compassion. No matter, I mean, as much as you can, you've got to find some space. It's just true. It's not humanly possible for you to be a saint every single day bearing this. You do your best. But you've got to find a way. I mean, maybe we'll talk about it in more detail when you email me.
Okay.
Email me. But this is something, you know, we forget about. The mind is the point. But we're human and we need certain conditions. It's inhuman to expect that you keep going perfectly, being a perfect little Buddhist and never get upset. It's just too much. And then you get guilty. And then you get all torn and twisted about that. It's impossible. It's not possible, darling. So I think we should talk privately. But any one of us, okay. That's why it is important if we have a job. It's necessary to have a break from it. If you've got a crazy mother, a crazy boyfriend, or a crazy son, it's important to try and find a way, all possible ways, to get a break from it, to find a way where you can have some space and regenerate yourself. We've got to do this, Lauren. Because we all, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just too much to bear. It's too hard, darling. It's just too hard. And then often what happens is we get so caught up with attachments and fears and guilt, we forget about it. We forget to try and do that because it's a necessary thing to do, you know. That's why if you live with a whole bunch of people and a whole bunch of kids, it's almost impossible to be saintly all the time. Even if you just go and close the toilet door for 10 minutes, you know, do something. I mean, we need to do something to get some, and to find them and to learn to use that time well. Instead of just feeling guilty and the mind on the whole time. We're going to have, that's why to develop practices, but even that 10 minutes, you can use it well to steady your mind. And that's for sure what we need to learn to do. That's why even just doing a 5-minute breathing meditation when you're feeling guilty and anxious, but so often the guilt and the anxiety just continue to overwhelm your mind. We've got to find the ways to be skillful to not, you can't expect not to be anxious, but to consciously find a way to concentrate for 5 minutes or watch your breath for 5 minutes or do yoga for 10 minutes or walk around the block for 5 minutes. We've got to really factor those things into our life. You've got to do that because that's when you can pick yourself up again. It's just intelligence. It's intelligent, you know? Mm-hmm. Do you understand?
Yes.
Good, Lauren. Thank you, Donna.
Thank you.
Who else, Donna?
Yes, Venerable. Joey, who's watching on YouTube, asked this question.
Yes.
How might we determine the best course of action, knowing that most actions are tainted with deluded states of mind?
This is the point, isn't it? So at the very first level, all we can do is control our body and speech. Then we begin to become our own therapist and learn to control our mind. Then we get to the compassion wing, the bodhisattva path, and this is where we can be much more skillful. You know, at the very first level, the wisdom wing, there's no wiggle room. You just try not to kill and not to lie and not to steal, not too much, not to eat too much cake, you know. You'd be very strict. But the compassion wing, given that we're ordinary human beings with lots of delusions, that's why I like Lauren's point, we've got to find some space we can do some practice. But the key other one here is the motivation. When we really understand, again, this is like a technical point. We have to eat. We have to sleep. Maybe you've got a husband, you know, you have to do other things with your husband. You want to do things that are usually driven by attachment. That's inevitable. And you can't not have attachment until you're highly realized. And most of us won't give up sex and drugs and rock and roll and husbands and mortgages and go to the mountains. So we're going to be living in an environment where attachments and delusions function. So with skillful means, learn to live it, keep in our vows, learn to control our body and speech, zip the lip as much as possible, try and learn to know your mind really well and distinguish between delusions and virtues, but then also remember to have a positive motivation for why you eat your breakfast and why you have your husband loving him in bed and why you go to work and why you do things that would be normally driven by attachment instead of fanatically going on, oh, I'm so attached, I shouldn't be like this. No, you put bodhicitta in on top of it. Then it lessens, it calms the attachment down. It's a skillful means. And when we go into more detail about karma, I'll describe this so we can really understand it, you know. Very important. Hope that helps. Time to go home.
Time to go home.
2 hours went very quickly as usual, isn't it? I hope there's some food for thought. I haven't lowered my voice, have I, since you saw me last? Still shout. I think when I get very old, I might calm down a bit. I'm waiting. Okay, people. 99% of what I even I've said, I don't remember. And 99% of what I've said, most of you don't remember, but nothing goes astray. It's all gone in, okay? So be very delighted that all these thoughts have gone in. And if even 1% of it makes sense, use that. You know, 1% is fine. But no, all the seeds have gone in. So what we dedicate, thinking all these amazing seeds we've planted, may we nourish them from this second forward, you know, without work, without effort, without, and then rejoice in our efforts. Life is hard. Having delusions is difficult, and even seeing them makes it even in a sense more difficult. But be courageous. Never give up, people. Know our amazing potential. And like we were talking before, don't just take the good stuff for granted, please. Rejoice unbelievably that anything good at all ever happens to us. This is the fruit of our non-lying and non-stealing and non-trilling and our generosity. We should be blissing out every day, and that gives us courage and optimism. You know? Don't just notice the weeds in the garden. Please notice the flowers, and they're both the result of your work. When you can own the flowers, it's easier to own the weeds. If you take the flowers for granted and get freaked out by the weeds, of course you get exhausted. So it's a very different approach. You know? So delight in our practice. Delight in our efforts. And never give up. Have enthusiasm. Okay?
Kewadinyo Jujag Lama Sange Drugyone Drawa Chikyang Malupa Jai Sala Kupasho.
Next one. Other prayer. Jamchub Central. Not there? I'll sing it. Bodhicitta. Just thinking now made bodhicitta, made compassion grow and grow in the hearts of all.
Jamchub Central Grimpoche. Ma ke panam ke gyuchi. Ke panyam pa me payam. Gong ne gong du pebasho.
Thank you everybody so much. Hope you can hear me again, Andre. Get close to your thing. Get close to your modem, Andre. That's all that matters. Alrighty, goodbye. Much love and see you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Bye tomorrow. Good, darlings. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, John. Thank you, everybody. Much love. See you tomorrow. Bye. I'm leaving you now. Bye.